Well, thanks, Chris, for a very interesting, I wouldn't say introduction, because you gave all the important physics, I think. But your talk and Tom's talk are actually both introductory in a sense to what I want to say, because you're talking about how these things might get born. And I want to talk about their lives and their deaths. I've always been interested in star death more than star birth. It's just part of my personality, I guess. But these first stars, if they were nearly as bright as you guys are saying, were the brightest stars ever born, the shortest lived stars ever born. And as you mentioned, they left their imprint on the universe through their nucleosynthesis and through the light that they emitted, both as stars and in their deaths. And such stars have been interesting for a long time, at least for 25 years. Ezra and Cameron, I think, did one of the first studies of the evolution of zero metal stars. And there's three or four ways that taking the metals out affects the evolution of the stars. First case, it affects the opacity. And by having only electron scattering opacity, essentially, you affect the pulsational stability of the star. The maximum mass of a star that can live and die without evaporating or pulsing apart, you affect the mass loss. And just how the mass loss is affected, the mass loss rates for zero metal stars or even for low metal stars is very much a controversial subject these days. Many people think it scales as a power of the metallicity, which might be 1/2 to 2/3, but we have no data on stars with zero metals, of course, and we don't know what mass loss rates to use, especially if they form red giants with no iron, as I'll come back to in a minute. And then the formation of red giants itself depends upon the opacity of the star. If there's no metals, then the star has a much harder time becoming a red giant, might die as a blue supergiant instead of a red one, and that affects its light curve and some other of the observational diagnostics. The second way taking the metals out affects the life of the star is that it changes the nuclear physics on the main sequence. And the thing that Ezra and Cameron pointed out that I always thought was really cute is that you'd think a star with no CNO would have to burn on the proton-proton cycle. And it does up to about 10 or 15 solar masses. But in the massive stars we're talking about here, the star is so clever it actually contracts and does a little bit of helium burning, makes about 10^-9 by mass fraction of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and then re-expands just a little bit and burns on the main sequence with this low metallicity. So it makes its own catalyst for the CNO cycle, burns at a temperature of about 100 million degrees. However, the stars, because their opacity is very low, are hotter and bluer on the main sequence. Here's a 120 solar mass star, the main sequence evolution for various metallicities, starting with solar and going down to zero metals. And you see the star maintains about the same luminosity history, but at a much hotter effective emission temperature, approaching almost 100,000 degrees. And here's some effective temperatures for stars of 10, 20, 50, and 100 solar masses that have no metals at all at about half helium depletion. So these are, as has already been mentioned, going to be very bright ultraviolet sources, and they're going to emit a large fraction, it turns out about, for the more massive stars, about 0.7% of their rest mass will come out as ultraviolet radiation on the main sequence. Even though the deaths of these stars can be quite dramatic, most of their energy output is on the main sequence because they're almost completely convective for the very massive ones. They live for an Eddington lifetime, about 2 million years for the more massive stars, and output about 0.7%, as I said, of their rest mass as radiation. Later, when they blow up as supernovae, the total kinetic energy will be more like 0.1% mc squared, and the fraction that comes out in light will be a small fraction of that. So most of the luminous output is on the main sequence, and of course the kinetic energy of the supernova can be quite different, much more violent and impulsive. Now, as I was mentioning, as you go to the heavier and heavier stars, they become almost completely convective. Their luminosity is about 2/3 of the Eddington maximum for their composition, and their lifetime approaches a constant of about 2 million years. So all the way from 100 to 300, the lifetime varies hardly at all. And the luminosity in units of 10^38 ergs per second divided by the mass and solar masses is about 1, to pretty good accuracy. Now, you can define four ranges, four kinds of deaths for these stars. First, and it's easier to speak in terms of the helium core, although of course the star has a hydrogen envelope, at least initially, and the relation between the helium core and the main sequence mass involves some uncertain stellar physics, but these are the approximate ranges. And between about 2 and 40 solar masses, you get the kind of stellar evolution and star death that we're used to in modern stars. The iron core, you go through your six stages of nuclear burning, produce an iron core that collapses on electron capture, photodisintegration, neutrino emission. And that iron core, if the mass of the star is not too big, produces a neutron star, and the neutron star, by its neutrino emission, is thought to provoke an explosion of the rest of the star, and you get left behind a neutron star. If that explosion is not violent enough, then some of the ejecta may fall back on the neutron star and push it over into a black hole, or if the iron core is bigger than about 2 solar masses, you may not even get a neutron star at all, but form a black hole promptly. So somewhere around 25 or 30 solar masses, you switch from making neutron stars to black holes, even in this mass range. Now, starting at 40 solar masses of helium, you get into a new domain where the contracting core, even after helium burning, as the star begins to burn carbon, it gets into a situation where as the pressure and temperature go up, the pressure doesn't go up as rapidly as gamma 4/3 would suggest, because some of the energy is being converted into the formation of rest mass of electrons and positrons. So we're starting to get into what's called the electron-positron pair instability, which characterizes all of these stars. And for stars in this range, helium cores in this range, star masses in this range, you have a violent pulsational instability in which the core goes unstable because of the pair instability, contracts, does some explosive burning and rebounds, but it doesn't rebound with enough energy to disrupt the entire star. So it kicks off the hydrogen envelope, part of the helium core, and then goes back through a Kelvin-Helmholtz evolution that in some cases lasts 10,000 years. So in this range, you can have a supernova 1, 2, even 5 times, I've seen in some cases, where the star contracts, blows up, kicks off some mass, kicks off another one, and so on. So a supernova repeatedly, and we call this the pulsational pair instability. Eventually, the core gets small enough that it moves back into this regime, and you probably produce a black hole. But in the meanwhile, you've pulsed off a lot of interesting mass. This is the cleanest regime. From 120 to 300 solar masses, which is most of what Tom and Chris were talking about this morning, although 30 is very important, as we'll come back to in a minute, you get into the pure pair instability supernova. They fall down, they explosively burn oxygen and silicon, they get enough energy to completely disrupt the star, they blow out with huge energy, nothing at all is left behind. The simplest supernova explosion mechanism ever proposed by humans, and it works every time, there's no doubt about it, it just relies on standard nuclear physics, equation of state, and so on. So the nice thing, there's lots of uncertainties we'll come to in this regime, which is very interesting to us today. The nice thing is the supernova is simple. It doesn't involve turbulent nuclear deflagration, it doesn't involve neutrino-driven convection and rotation and MRI and all of that. It's simple, and the same simplicity allows us to say that 1 over the fine structure constant, somebody planned this, I suppose, if the helium core is over 137 solar masses, it falls down, but the binding goes as m squared and the fuel only goes as m, and so you reach a mass, as has been known since the 80s, or before, I believe, Bond, Arnett, and Carr did a lot of work on this, where the implosion continues and isn't reversed, and unless you have a whole lot of rotation, this isn't changed very much. And so above this, you go straight into black holes. And that's a situation that probably persists all the way up to 100,000 solar masses. So everything above about 300 solar masses ends up making a black hole. Now, if it's rotating, the black hole can do interesting things too, and we'll come back to that later. Now, this is a diagram that Alex Hager and I put together a couple of years ago, and it's rather complicated, but it really just says with a lot of bars what I've already told you, and that is below about 7 or 8 solar masses, even in zero metal stars, you get relatively long-lived stars that still end up making white dwarfs and asymptotic giant branch stars. But these stars up here have lived and died several times before this ever happens. Then we get the usual supernova range where you leave neutron stars And then there's a range from maybe 25 or 30 on up to about 120, where you either make a black hole by fallback or you make a pulsational pair instability supernova, but your remnant is black holes. And then in this regime, nothing is left behind, and here it's all black holes. So black hole, nothing, black hole, neutron star, white dwarf. And the green is the shading where heavy elements might be ejected. So you can get nucleosynthesis from these guys. You get some uncertain nucleosynthesis from the pulsational pair, and then a lot of nucleosynthesis per unit mass, if you ever make stars of 200 solar masses. Now, a lot of numbers on the board, but it's really just to say that we've done a lot of models now. These are one-dimensional models. All stellar evolution models that go from main sequence to supernovae are one-dimensional. We've done 126 different masses, all of zero metallicity, and exploded them in some cases with six different energies. Now, in the range down here where you're making neutron stars, in fact, for all of these stars, the explosion mechanism is still complicated, so we simulate that by taking the iron core out and putting a piston where the edge of the iron core, in fact, where entropy equals 4 is our demarcation, and move the piston with different speeds so as to produce explosions of different energies. But altogether, 500 different models were studied, and so I can talk about the results that we got using an implicit 1D hydro code, a good equation of state, nuclear reaction networks of typically 1,000 isotopes, explosions with pistons, no mass loss, and we also calculated the light curves of these supernovae, which are interesting. These are not the pair instability supernovae, which I'll come to next. These are the ones down below 100 solar masses, and here's a typical yield plot. So if everything lined up on one here, you'd have the solar abundances, and the typical production factor is about 10 times that of the Sun in an explosion with 1.2 times 10 to the 51 ergs, which was what 87A had. And you see the production of oxygen and magnesium and silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium, and so on. And the results are pretty solar, but there are large odd-even effects that you wouldn't have seen if this had been a solar metal star. Aluminum and sodium and phosphorus and potassium are all down. And the neutron-rich isotopes of all the elements, this is silicon 28, silicon 29, and 30. The neutron-rich isotopes are all low. This is a generic characteristic of low-metal stars. They don't have the CNO that makes the excess neutrons that are needed to make the odd isotopes and the neutron-rich isotopes. And so they have a characteristic pattern which is neutron deficient. And so some general features are large odd-even effect, odd charge, even charge nuclei, no synthesis above mass 64 unless you put in something called the neutrino-powered wind. As the neutron star forms, the outer layers, the outer hundredth of a solar mass can be blown away by the neutrinos, and there it's thought the R process occurs, so you would get R process in these stars. And lately, two groups have also found very appreciable yields of scandium and zinc in these neutrino-powered winds. And I know zinc is an interesting element to a lot of people here. And it looks like zinc and scandium as well may be primary, produced down very close to the neutron star in the wind. Boron and fluorine are primary, produced by the neutrino flux flowing through the exploding star by the neutrino process. Here's a very critical thing that we're going to come back to several times. Above about 50 solar masses, and in fact starting even at 25, if the star has any rotation, and to some extent even if it doesn't, the hydrogen convective envelope and the helium convective core touch sometime during helium burning, mixing a little bit of carbon and hydrogen together in an almost explosive event. And the larger stars it is explosive, you produce a lot of nitrogen. And then suddenly a star whose hydrogen envelope had no carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, it suddenly has a lot. And then it tries to adjust for that new structure, which in some sense resembles high metallicity stars, except there's no iron. So primary nitrogen production is something that we've observed, other people have observed for these low metal stars. And, you know, to cut to the answer, for the stars not including the pair instability, so stopping at 100 solar masses, there's a lot on this graph, so I'll take a minute or two to go through it. First is the data, the black dots in the error bars. This is from Kirel et al., 2004. And this is their best, these are observers who have looked at a lot of metal deficient stars and made a composite of what they think the composition looked like when the metallicity was 10 to the minus 3, that of the Sun. So it's no single star, it's a composite of a number of stars, but they say this is the prompt inventory, this is what you needed to have when the metallicity was 1,000th that of the Sun, the black dots and the error bars. Now, the blue crosses are what we get if we take our models all for one constant explosion energy. And as you get up to 30 and 40 solar masses, most of the nucleosynthesis falls back down and you make a black hole. So this is largely for the stars under 40 solar masses, maybe under 35. And if you fold in a saltpeter initial mass function, then you get the blue X's. And everything is normalized to magnesium here. So magnesium is one. And so we actually overproduce sodium a little bit. But sodium may be subject to non-LTE corrections, and I'm not too worried about missing it by 0.2 dex. Aluminum, we're a little bit down on. It's a little hard, in fact, to simultaneously make aluminum high and sodium low because they're both odd mass nuclei, and they usually end up being comparable in the results. Silicon is good. Potassium is good. Calcium. Titanium is not so bad. Chromium is awful. Manganese is good. Iron is good. Cobalt we're down on, nickel is good, and zinc we're down on. However, the neutrino-powered wind can make the scandium and the zinc, so we can move this point up somewhere around here, and scandium can come up a good bit. Chromium, no one has ever understood this low chromium abundance that the observers keep telling us, and my conclusion is that the observers are wrong. And, you know, their conclusion may be that I'm wrong, but there are non-LTE corrections that affect chromium, at least one paper said so, and the nuclear physics speaks to me that you just cannot make this low chromium to iron ratio in any star we've ever seen. So this is the exception that proves the case. Now what is the case? Oh, there's also another set of red points if we use a very high explosion energy, as Ken Nemoto has talked about using. And the agreement is not improved. In fact, it may even get a little worse if you worry about scandium, and it's just awful on potassium. And the reason is, with a huge explosion energy, you eject, you do explosive processing in a lot of material further out from the center, where the neutron excess is smaller, and you get a bigger odd even effect. And so, raising the explosion energy, if you wanted to do that to make zinc, for example, kills you on some other elements. These are all zero metal stars, and here is my first point. To the extent that we all have errors, the observers and the theorists alike, I think this is pretty good agreement. There's nothing that jumps out and says you need another component in order to understand this. Conversely, as we'll come to in a minute, if I fold the very massive stars in, it doesn't mess up the agreement so long as their proportion was not huge. If all the stars were over 200 solar masses, the agreement would be lousy. We'll come to that in a minute.
Could you just say why it was that you were taking data that was not zero metallicity with the next generation of stars? But how many?
Yeah. Okay. No stars below about 10 solar masses would have contributed appreciably here. So we're including 10 to 100, and the evolution from 0 to 10 to the minus 3 solar is something we are doing. It's in progress, but it won't change things very much. So this is just massive star nucleosynthesis. SN1A is 1A supernovae, and AGBs haven't contributed yet. The light curves of these stars are also interesting, and they're a whole lot like 87A. Because the metallicity in 87A was low, it was a blue supergiant. At least that's one explanation. The metallicity is low in these stars. They are also blue supergiants when they die. This little bump could be gotten rid of with more mixing. The hump is the decay of radioactive nickel. And the point is, they all have about the same peak luminosity as 87A, a little bit brighter. They're not exceptionally brilliant, and they wouldn't leap out at the high redshifts where these stars might exist. 35 solar masses, same thing. When we get to 50, though, things are starting to change. What's changed is the primary nitrogen production has become so large that this star is a red supergiant. This one was a blue. And that makes a great difference on the light curve. A type 1A supernova would go up to 10 to the 43 and go back down again about that quick. So this is brighter than a type 1A supernova and lasting, you know, 100 to 200 days. So these are starting to be interesting objects. Here is their nickel mass, 50 solar mass star. We're starting to talk around 0.6 solar masses of nickel. And this is the range of explosion energies we considered, from 3 times 10 to the 50, where everything falls back in these big stars. And you don't get any radioactivity out, hence it's very, very faint, all the way up to 10 times 10 to the 51 ergs. So that's the supernova. I mean, of course, the way these stars could really be bright is if they made gamma ray bursts, and this is the mass range that we think gamma ray bursts originate from, and there's some direct evidence in modern times for that. If the stars are able to lose their envelopes, and if the rotation is high enough, then you will make a gamma ray burst in these stars. And there's a whole long story that goes along with that, but both of these are necessary. I'll just illustrate one of them. This is a relativistic jet inserted into a blue supergiant, like one of these stars would be. And after 100 seconds, the jet is still inside the star. If we'd taken the hydrogen envelope off, the jet would have erupted a long time ago. So the only way to make gamma ray bursts in stars that have not lost their envelopes, even if they're blue supergiants, is to make the jet stay on for longer than 100 seconds. So you could potentially get gamma ray bursts from these stars in one of two ways. Either, even as a blue supergiant, they had a close binary companion and they lost their envelope to the companion, or it was a very long gamma ray burst, 200, 300 seconds. So now about the great big stars, the ones over 100 solar masses. As I've said, the very good thing about these stars is their explosion mechanism is very simple. Their mass loss may be negligible, caveat having to do with the primary nitrogen. I'll come back to that. The composition initially is well known, and they're pulsationally stable. There's been a lot of work on these stars back in the 70s and 80s, sort of a dormant field in the 90s, and then lately it's become very interesting again. Basically, the idea, as I already said, is that when you get to a high enough entropy, a massive enough star, your evolution in temperature and density space takes you into a region where you produce electron-positron pairs, reducing the structural adiabatic index below 4/3. The star collapses rapidly, and then it gets into the photodisintegration regime where it loses energy. And if it spends too long in here, it never comes out again. It becomes a black hole, but it can briefly go in here, bounce out again, and disrupt. And so these were the four ranges. I don't think I'll go through that again. The first issue has to do with the pulsational stability of 200 solar mass stars. One reason that we quit working on these stars in the 90s was the general consensus that even if you ever made them, they would pulse apart. We don't see any stars above about 100, 150 solar masses these days, and it's because they're pulsationally unstable, both due to the epsilon instability, the nuclear energy generation being pulsationally unstable, and more particularly because of the opacity instability. But if you take the metals out of the star, you affect both of those instabilities. And what Baraf and Hager and I found was that for zero metal stars, they were pulsationally stable, up to about 500 solar masses. And so if you were born a big star, you would die a big star, at least so far as pulsational stability went. Now, that's the good thing. The bad thing is, first, whether they exist, and we're hearing a lot about this, whether they ever existed. The mixing between the hydrogen and the helium convective core makes this primary nitrogen, which makes the star want to be a red supergiant. And the details of how this mixing occurs are sensitive to the rotation and to the parameterization of things like semiconvection, convective overshoot. Rotation plays a big role in the deaths and evolution of these stars, as I'll come to. And we have no observations for guidance for zero metal stars. But what we assume, for lack of anything better, is that they have the same rotation as modern stars, modern O stars, which are rapid rotators, typical rotation velocities around 200 to 400 kilometers per second for modern O stars. If these stars have rotation rates that fast, it affects their evolution quite a bit. And the fourth problem is that the so-called opal opacities which people use to study stellar evolution, the metallicity is a parameter there, but you can't independently vary CNO and iron. And so it's hard to know what to do when you have a hydrogen envelope which has 5% carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in it, so it can make dust, for example, but it has no iron. What do you use for the opacities there? And what do you use for the mass loss rates there? In modern stars, here's a 25 solar mass star. This shows the extent of the convection region, and it's compressed. This is on a logarithmic scale, with this being 1 second and this being 1 million years. So hydrogen burns, and that actually takes most of the time. Hydrogen, the convective region shrinks as the star evolves, and then when helium burns, the helium convective core grows. But they never touch each other in these solar metallicity stars. In a star of either 250 or 300 solar masses with no metals, the main sequence evolution, maybe it's easier to see on this star, even I can't read this diagram. This has to be one of the champion spaghetti plots. I just made it a few nights ago. It needs cleaning up, obviously. But what it would show is that the hydrogen convection region is shrinking, and then when helium grows, it touches it, and there's almost an explosion, and you become a red supergiant. Maybe it's easier to see on this. At helium ignition, here's the composition of a 200 solar mass star, helium, and hydrogen, and helium convection is reaching right out to here, and the hydrogen profile left by the hydrogen core burning convective core is this, and you can see they're just getting ready to touch there, and they do touch, and then you get a lot of nitrogen, carbon, and oxygen mixed out, and the star becomes a red giant, which dramatically affects its light curve. And since these regions are both convective, there's a huge amount of shear between this core and the envelope, and so there's rotational mixing as well, which tends to promote this nitrogen production. So once we've made a metal-rich envelope with no iron, we're in uncharted territory about what to do about the mass loss rates. For the moment, for simplicity, we've assumed them to be zero. And then we did another survey of helium cores on a coarser grid covering the entire parent stability region, and we also did full stars of four masses. This is a typical pair instability result. 70 solar mass helium core contracts, burns at about 3 or 4 billion degrees, explodes, and makes lots of silicon, lots of oxygen, no iron hardly at all. And so its production looks like this. It's very oxygen silicon rich and iron deficient. If you raise the mass, go up to 130 solar masses, you get deeper into the pair instability, you make oxygen and silicon, but a lot of iron in the form of nickel 56. Production factors look like this. It's an iron-rich star. Now, we don't quite know what initial mass function to use, obviously, but if we take, I'm going to skip this. Take this whole grid, and here's the explosion energy, ranging all the way from just around 10 to the 51 ergs up to almost 10 to the 53 ergs until you finally make a black hole and it goes abruptly to zero. This is the nickel 56 mass going up to 50 solar masses of radioactive nickel. That's about 100 times more than a type 1A supernova makes.
Was that in your earlier calculations, you varied the explosion energy?
Here we don't have to. Here we don't have to because the explosion is well understood. Yes. And here is the elemental yield from this range of stars, and what you see is a huge odd-even effect. Silicon to phosphorus, here's two orders of magnitude, so the typical ratio of even elements to odd elements is 1.5 dex to 2 dex. And this is a characteristic signature of these stars that have no metals. And so it's something you might look for. Now, if you take those stars and combine them, you say the saltpeter initial mass function extended on down to 15 solar masses, then you get something with a decreased odd-even effect. And then these are the stars that we had before, the core collapse stars from under 100 solar masses. Well, running out of time, but let me just summarize by saying there is no clear evidence for this kind of nucleosynthesis in any metal-deficient sample we've looked at so far. However, bimetallicity minus 3, which is all the sample we essentially have, there are a few stars with minus 4. Maybe this has already been washed out. So there's not evidence for or entirely against, except it's clear that the metallicity at minus 3 was not produced entirely by very massive stars, or even by a saltpeter IMF folded across the entire mass range. Now, might we see these things? You get explosion energies up to 10 to the 53 ergs, up to 50 ergs or even more solar masses of nickel. Here's the light curve of a 200 solar mass red supergiant, pair instability supernova, and a type 1a supernova again would have been like a little blip here at the origin. This is maybe 100 type 1a supernovae. It's brighter by a factor of about 3 and lasts even in its frame almost a year. Of course, you have to move this out and redshift it. Here is a star a little bit heavier, calculation by Sergei Blinnikov, 250 solar masses, 10 to the 44 ergs per second, so 10 type 1a supernovae. Here's the comparison of the UBV light curves to a typical type 2 supernova, about a factor of 10 brighter. Now, Phil Pinto has taken that model and run light curves with his radiation transport code and looked at it through various filters and also determined what it would look like to various instruments. And probably the UBV RI will have been redshifted out of our visibility. But if you go to 10 microns, you get something that's pretty bright, the blue curve here, around 26th magnitude, at redshift 20. And in fact, at redshift 10 and redshift 5, it's just about equally bright. It's pretty much independent of the redshift. That's because as you go to higher redshift, you're putting a larger fraction of the luminosity into your observable band, which compensates for the greater distance. The shock breakout transients, as the shock erupts from the surface is briefly heated to very high temperature, about 1,000,000 degrees, 2 times 10 to the 45 ergs per second for 2 hours. This would be marvelous if it was nearby, but if you redshift this by 20, probably the Lyman alpha absorption takes it away. You can get even brighter supernovae if you take the hydrogen envelope off, then you can get almost to 10 to the 44 and a half ergs per second. So this makes it very important whether it's in a binary or not, because that would be the way to remove the envelope. If the mass is 60 solar masses, it's unobservable though. This is the helium mass now, not the star mass. Okay. Coming rapidly to an end, I see. The breakout in these helium cores can also produce mildly relativistic ejecta, and that might make a very bright X-ray source for a while. Although this is the duration of this is only a fraction of a second. We can go back to some of this if you're interested. The most exciting possibility is whether you might make gamma ray bursts in these very massive stars. They're making black holes. If they've lost their envelope, or even if they don't, you can get a very long gamma ray burst. Calculations by Fryer and Hager and I have shown that you can get super gamma ray bursts, things 100 times more brilliant even than the gamma ray bursts that we're used to, the isotropic energies of 10 to the 55 ergs. But the rub there is that it's very sensitive to the rotation. If you took 200 kilometers per second on the main sequence, you would not have enough angular momentum to form a disk. If you took 400, you have to be above the red line, it turns out, to make a disk. This is a Schwarzschild last stable orbit, a Kerr last stable orbit, and this is the last stable orbit for the angular momentum that you actually have. Only if you had a rotation rate of 30% Keplerian would you be able to make a disk in these stars. Now, there might be other ways of making gamma ray bursts aside from disk formation around black holes, but since these stars, you know, much more than their lower mass counterparts are more likely to make black holes, if collapsars are going to happen, they're going to happen in these. But it's very sensitive to the rotation, and you need a lot of it in order to make a gamma ray burst. So to summarize, this evolution of these sorts of stars are certainly quite different from their higher metallicity counterparts. Stars of up to 500 solar masses may, if they are ever formed, may live until they die. They make primary nitrogen, which makes their evolution rather complicated. They can form red supergiants, and if they are red supergiants, they can be exceptionally bright supernovae, possibly even gamma ray bursts. The nucleosynthesis is novel, but there's no compelling evidence for it in the sample that we've observed so far. And one thing we would really like to know is how the rotation and the binary membership of these stars varies with mass and with metallicity. Zero metallicity Are they rapidly rotating? Are they in binaries? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So,
two questions. One is, you said a pulsational instability suppressed from metal free stars.
So how high does the metallicity need to be?
We didn't explore that in detail, but it looked like around minus 4.
Okay. Second question is, in your yield calculations, so you assumed the stars are not rotating?
Actually, some of the plots I showed were for rotating stars. It unless it gets to be a very large amount, it doesn't affect it much. The chief way it affects it is by making the helium core for a given star much larger. So the helium core resulting from a 300 solar mass star can vary from 130 to 190 solar masses, depending on what we've dialed in for the rotation.
It's a difficult question, but can you give some guidance as to, you know, kind of what physical effects might be important that you haven't put in? How serious should you take those yields quantitatively? I mean, is it...
Well, of course, the biggest uncertainty is whether such stars ever existed. I leave that to someone else.
Sure, sure.
The second is the role of rotation and how much rotation there is there. And then the third one is the physics of this mixing that causes the primary nitrogen production, which affects the helium core mass and all the observable diagnostics. Okay.
You didn't talk about the mechanical energy injected by these systems. Presumably there's a large fraction of the total energy goes into mass, motion, and winds, and therefore that will affect the IGM and the system in which this is being born in a major way. And
talked about it indirectly. First I said we neglected mass loss, so that's the first.
Well, I'm talking about the supernova blast.
There were no winds. But if you make these red hypergiants, these 3 times 10 to the 14 centimeter radius stars that are full of nitrogen, probably they do have appreciable mass loss. That'll be very low velocity material, though. It'll be, you know, 10 kilometer per second, but a lot of it.
Well, I guess I was talking about is the velocity data at high redshift for the Lyman Alpha Far shows the systems are moderately quiescent. These things, presumably, when the supernova goes off, stir in a lot of mechanical energy.
Well, I did. It went fast, I'm afraid, but I did give a plot of that. Here.
Right.
This is all kinetic energy. And it ranges from 10 to the 51 to 10 to the 53 ergs, depending on the mass of the helium core.
And so how does that, I mean, I guess someone else has to answer, I guess, how does that affect the region in which these explosions are occurring?
And well, I think Tom and Mike will address that.
Okay.
Yeah, I had another possible record of this, I guess, would be intermediate mass black holes, and there's a pretty lively debate going on in the X-ray community about whether or not detected black holes with, say, 100 to 1,000 solar masses. So those, I guess, are a prediction of the highest mass regime, is that right?
Yeah. A strong prediction is that if the helium core is over 137 solar masses, you'll make a black hole. Relating that to the mass of the star, whether this is a 300 solar mass or a 260 solar mass star is uncertain. Still more uncertain is the black hole production down in the lower mass range, but that won't make 100 solar mass black holes.
You mentioned that we don't observe the abundance patterns that you predict for the high mass regime, but
yeah.
Could it be that it's related to the explosion energy being so large that you dilute? I mean, all these metals are being expelled to greater distances. Mm-hmm. Than for low mass supernovae. So in fact they are diluted not just by the mass function of stars but also by the mixing of the metals with the surrounding gas.
Yes, I haven't commented on what fraction of the metallicity this would make, and I haven't worked on that. Clearly there's a long distance between 0 and 10 to the minus 3 where we have solid data. And, you know, the hope might be that we'd find a few isolated, very metal-poor stars that might have a really huge odd-even effect visible.
A related question would be that if the metals don't mix up very well, then I know you put your pairing stability supernovae as equal 20, but it could be that some low-redshift star formation with primordial gas might be occurring at z equal 2 or 3. A perinstability supernova would be easily distinguished from a type 1A just because of total energy or light curve?
Yeah, duration especially. And they would be type 2.
Can we rule that out?
Nothing like this has been seen so far as I know, but it is an exciting prospect that they could be nearby. Let me ask you, if we had one of these very hard ultraviolet transients or even some of the X-ray breakouts, could they make it, could their radiation make it here at redshift 3 or 4?
It's a related comment to what Pierre is saying. Another consequence of inhomogeneous enrichment is that if you did find a 10 to the minus 4 star, it doesn't mean that its abundances are typical of a metal 3 star. It might by itself be a population 3 star, but its metals may have been produced by a 10 to the minus 2 star.
That's right. But it's you know, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition.
Yeah.
I'd just like to point out that another key argument for why the perinstability supernovae did not completely dominate the early metal abundant or metal enrichment is that the lowest metallicity stars usually contain R process elements. Many of them do, and so that is associated with the lower mass range.
Yeah, these big guys don't make any R process or S process.
Then a question for you: how well can you calculate the yields from that perinstability mass range that doesn't completely explode, the 4 to 5
pulsational pair?
Right.
That's a real tough. It's a challenge. We're doing it. We've done one, but you know, you have to let the star explode, take off the stuff that came off, let the rest relax, and it's.
Can you give us a hint as to whether it looks more like the higher mass?
Well, I think for the most part, you're going to get the envelope and some nitrogen, and all the rest is going to go into a hole anyway.
Okay, so not significant for.
Probably not very significant.
Good.
I also have a question for Peter. Peter Valparigo and Chiosi, which they claim that there could be winds from this, you know, stars as
yes.
much as the 1,000 wind enriching nitrogen and oxygen, mm-hmm. I recall. So, any comment
on that? That would certainly change things. If you have a
Okay. So I was mentioning the fact that there is a paper by Marigo and Chiosi in which they are looking at the mass loss from stars with masses 1,000 or 500 to 1,000. They claim that there is a considerable mass loss in nitrogen and oxygen, if I recall correctly.
Here's how extreme it could be. If you had a primary nitrogen-producing event, and in our calculations all of them are in that mass range, and you made a red giant, and you had a lot of mass loss and you lost the envelope, then you've made a very massive Wolf-Rayet star. The customary mass loss rates for Wolf-Rayet star scale is a power of their mass, and they're huge for these big stars. You could end up with a 5 solar mass helium core after you started with a 200 solar mass star. But I hope that there are holes along the way. That didn't happen. But.
There are models which predict that in both core collapse supernovae and perinstability supernovae, you have considerable production of dust. So a lot of the metals which are produced by your modeling in the gas phase mm-hmm. can be actually depleted in solid grains. So this might change also your conclusions about the comparison with the data of the composition of the oldest.
I see what you're saying. Yes, could be. I mean, the culprit, if I understand what you're saying, is again the primary nitrogen, because along with the primary nitrogen, there's some primary carbon. And so it's CNO, really, not just N, that's mixed out into the envelope. And that can make dust and other compounds. Oh, okay.
In the ejecta itself, so
yeah,
it will affect not only the CNO elements, but also.
There's been some argument about whether zinc or some of the heavier elements are depleted.
I don't know. I mean,
it's one reason I believe that magnesium is chosen as the normalization point, because it's thought to be less affected by that. It could affect Lyman alpha systems, for example. In stars, I don't think it would affect it much.
One last question. Urgent. No? Well, then, thank you very much. We're waiting
sure.
for coffee. And we have